From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at a family restaurant where a server named Andrea found herself back in the food service industry after waiting tables on and off for 6 years. Andrea left the business to become a scuba instructor, but when her mother became ill, she decided to pick up a second job bartending and serving at the restaurant. Andrea says after taxes, her paycheck is zero, and she lives off the tips that she brings home every night. And she says, quote, "I feel trapped as where the current minimum wage is set. I do make more on average than an employee earning minimum wage. However, on several nights, I do average less than $7 an hour, and my company will not ever compensate for that loss." End quote. Andrea shared her story with the pro-labor group Restaurant Opportunity Centers United. She's one of hundreds of thousands of tip workers in the United States. Many are advocating for a minimum wage equal to that of all other workers on top of their tips. And here in New York, Governor Cuomo wants to end the state's tip credit, saying the tipped wage system inhibits workers who earn tips from coming forward with concerns about exploitation and harassment. He says it disproportionately affects women and people of color. And advocates for the One Fair Wage campaign agree. Some go further to say that the restaurant business needs an overhaul, and we need to change our expectations about what workers are paid. They think that a business that can't pay workers a living wage should not open in the first place. And our guests in studio today will make the case not only for that model, but we'll talk more to them about their perspective. Because you might remember a couple weeks ago on this program, we talked about this issue, and we heard from a restaurant owner, we heard from servers, we heard from managers, and largely what we heard was an opposition to the governor's ideas on this. A viewpoint saying that the current system works pretty well. But certainly the Fight for 15 and other campaigns disagree. And this is a chance to hear their perspective and broaden the conversation as well. So let me go ahead and welcome our guests in studio. Colin O'Malley is Organizing Director of Metro Justice. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here, Colin.
Thanks, Evan.
Zach Skinner is a local restaurant worker and a leader in the One Fair Wage effort, serves at Lento. Zach, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Also here is Nadine Morsch, and she is a server at the Dutch Mill. She is a restaurant worker and a leader in the One Fair Wage effort as well. Nadine, welcome to you.
Thanks so much.
You got it. And welcome to the program, Mohini Sharma, who was on the line with us for a good part of the hour last program we had on this subject. She's in studio with us now. She's a restaurant worker organizer for Metro Justice and a former bartender and server as well. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. And Colin, you too, former restaurant experience as well.
Yeah, I've got about 10 years of food service experience before coming here, from everything from busing, dishwashing, waiting, sort of everything.
Okay. So before we get to the broader questions on how a society operates and what's acceptable and what baselines we want to set, let's zero right in on the tip worker credit. And Colin, I'll start with you just because Colin sent me a note after the last program and wanted to make sure the voices of the people at this table are heard, the voices of this movement are heard. So for the viewpoints that were repped largely on this program last time, Colin, which was general managers, owners, some servers, who said, this system works pretty well. It's the people in the back of the house who need more help. It's not tipped workers. And that this is going to be a disruptive model for restaurants that already feel a little strapped and have thin margins. What's the first response you have for that?
Well, I mean, if we look at restaurant work in the Rochester-Monroe area, it's pretty easy to tell that that's not the case, right? The Rochester-Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative put out a wage report last year that went into this and found that the restaurant industry, in even including waiters and waitresses, is one of the highest poverty jobs in the area. So the median hourly wage for a restaurant worker in the Monroe, in the Rochester metropolitan area, was $9.78 an hour. To say that that's a system that's working pretty well, while leaving roughly half of the people that work in it in poverty. Meanwhile, restaurants actually in many ways are thriving, and there's this sort of booming foodie world, right? I have a hard time seeing how that's working well.
Okay. And so interesting with Zach Skinner here, and Zach is a server at Lento for what you said about the past 6 months? Is that right?
Yep. Around 6 or 7 months now.
Okay. How's it going there?
It's going pretty great. It's kind of my first foray into the serving part of the service industry. I've been in the service industry for the 6 or 7 years, mostly as a barista and doing other work that is tipped, that is paid at the minimum wage. And so I attempted, I'm kind of going into the service industry with the idea, with the hope that I could be making more so that I could, like, do some other things in my life that I've been putting off since then. And so I've been trying to find the balance, of, like, am I making more money out of this? And I haven't found that it's necessarily propelled me as far as I was hoping it would. And it's been kind of a similar experience as to with as my coffee shop job, making around the same amount, the security is around the same, the stability is around the same. I don't think that that's what workers deserve.
Okay, and so serving at Lento, which again, for listeners who haven't been there, it's one of the really outstanding restaurants in mm-hmm. Rochester, and certainly higher end in terms of menu prices. Not the highest, but on the higher end, certainly. Are you making significantly more than minimum wage, for example?
I haven't found that I am. I mean, that it varies so much from week to week. I mean, in particular, since I've been there for now, you know, around a year of the kind of different seasons that we experience in the service industry, seeing both the uptick during the spring, but then like this plunge in the last several months has shown me that the stability doesn't really afford you those higher wages that like you're told about going in. And though some weeks, you know, you can make 3 to 4 times as much as you might make 1 week, that doesn't really allow me to plan my life in the way that I'd hoped I would.
But have you averaged out what you're making?
No, I haven't done like it varies so much. I've tried, like I do budgets, for instance, to mm-hmm. try and get a better sense of where my finances are being spent. But it's so impossible to estimate what's going to happen the next week that I've not been able to like get a regular like median number of what I'm making.
The owner and chef of Lento, Art Rogers, was on this program a couple of weeks ago, and Art said that he considers himself a pretty progressive-minded guy, but in this case, if this tip credit changes, he thinks that it could be a situation where he has to eliminate some or all of the service staff, find a different model, or close. And, you know, I mean, Art says he didn't want to do that, but that's the reality for his books. And you work at Lento. What do you say to that?
You know, like, with all due respect, like, for me, this issue isn't about anything particular to Lento or Art. You know, it's something that I identified in the service industry going years back now. And that just the reality of like having to shut down because of something like this doesn't make sense to me. Like it's a $2.90 raise. And as you said, we do have a very high price point. You know, we have a very stable set of people. We've been around a decade now. But even, you know, going beyond Lent to other to other restaurants, it just doesn't make sense to me that an industry that draws in so much money and that has, you know, proliferated over the last, you know, and kept on in this like, you know, country's history. It doesn't make sense that would all like go apart with like raising $2.90. And like that affects me, but it also affects, you know, servers in other restaurants that have like much higher, you know, price points and have even less tips coming in. So I think it's like a broader issue than just like my particular restaurant. I think that it's definitely a standard that's been set for like decades now that's just wrong, you know, that puts service industry workers at like a sub tier, that they don't get the respect and the rights that they deserve, I think, as professionals, as we should be seen.
Okay. Nadine Morsch, who works at the Dutch Mill, has how much experience in serving?
Including barista work, so at the tip minimum, mm-hmm. I have about 6 or 7 years experience.
Okay, so how do you view this issue, having heard those viewpoints from the GMs, the owners, some of the servers who say, we're doing pretty well, you know, this is not the right emphasis to put on it?
I gotta wonder when we lost the Ford standard, because I can't afford to eat at Lento, and I work at another small business in Rochester. And I think that many of my peers would really like to be able to spend our free time and some amount of disposable income being patrons at the places where we work or at the places where our friends work. And right now, that's not economically feasible for us, really. And the entire feast or famine problem of whether or not we're going to be getting enough tips to meet our bills that week does make budgeting pretty impossible, to a point where we are lacking an inherent stability that, and in a kind of way, we're like trading it for, because we would have that stability, I think, at a minimum wage job a little bit more. We would at least have a consistent amount of money to plan on. But in a way, we're almost trading it for that 1 week that we do really, really well and we come home with like $200 extra in tips. And it's this incredible boon. It's almost like gambling, but it's our pay, though. That's our wage, like, and it's almost the same thrill of gambling for your stability. It's a little messed up.
All right, so Mohini, as someone now who is a restaurant worker organizer with Metro Justice and having had plenty of experience yourself in this industry, How do you view this sort of the front of the house, back of the house? One of the pushbacks we got a couple of weeks ago was some callers, some listeners who said, look, I work in the restaurant industry. I'm more concerned that front of the house does better than the back of the house, and there should be more equity there as opposed to looking at the tip worker credit. What do you say about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, like Nadine and Zach have already said, that like how well front of house does is really, really unstable, and it's really unpredictable. In fact, if you look at the statewide statistics on this, the median wage for servers and bartenders is no more than $11 an hour. And that's right about on par with what a lot of back-of-house workers make, which is usually somewhere between the minimum wage and $12 an hour. So really,
so you think that disparity isn't as large as some people claim?
First of all, yes, that disparity isn't as large as most people claim.
Okay. And so then piggybacking off that, you've heard what Zach and Nadine had to say. I know you were a participant in the last program for quite a bit of the hour, and you heard a lot of what not just the owner of Lento, but also a GM at a local restaurant. I heard from other owners at restaurants around town saying, you know, we don't want to make this adversarial with workers, but we want to stay open. So the pushback that you have to that is what?
The pushback that I have to that is that in the 7 other states that have passed One Fair Wage and have the same minimum wage for servers and bartenders as other workers, is that business in those states has actually increased and the restaurant industry as a whole has been booming. So overall, it's not only better for workers and really significantly combats the poverty that is so prevalent among servers and bartenders, as well as the rates of sexual harassment they face. It actually has been good for restaurants because the restaurant industry employs so many people, that's so many more people that can now afford to go out at restaurants, just like Nadine was saying.
All right. And so for Colin and Mohini, what I want to do is try to clarify as best I can. I brought up some data in the last program. I want to hit it again because I truly just want to see the clearest picture possible. You know, I mean, as someone who is an evidence guy and I want to learn as much as I can, what you hear are some complete competing claims about the health of the industry. So let me read from Forbes again. And then I want to hear from Colin and Mohini about how they view the state of the industry. Forbes reports that the latest data from the Census Bureau shows that New York lost more than 500 restaurants statewide in 2016 after years of steady increases in the number of total restaurants. And broadening the metric to include all food service businesses, it shows a similar trend. New York lost more than 400 of those businesses in 2016, the first time the state had a net drop in food service in nearly 2 decades. And Forbes is coinciding this with the growth in worker wages, server wages from, what was it, $5 to $7.50, I think, at the time. And so they're drawing a line there. And they're saying that the industry is not as healthy as the picture that you guys are painting. So help me see it from your perspective.
Yeah, to be honest, that's a claim. I've been on here a number of times talking about the minimum wage, and that claim's been, those sort of claims have been made over and over and over and over again. And, you know, I'm not sure about the specific stats about restaurants opening and closing. What I do know is that economists have been saying for a long time that there's a glut of restaurants opening and that that's a dangerous business to jump into right now
There's no question that's true. Banks, if you want to have a bank turn you down, ask to open a restaurant.
Totally.
I think there have been a bunch
of very risky restaurants open in the first place. But that said, over probably 7, 8 years now, I've been in here 3 or 4 times having this conversation about raising wages. Every single time, I've been told that we're going to lose jobs, that we're going to close businesses. And I'm looking at the Bureau of Labor Statistics data right now on full-service restaurant employment every year. And between 2008 and now, it's gone from 254,000 restaurant jobs in New York State to 341,000 restaurant jobs in New York State. And those have been years of raises after raises after raises, which has actually shown that redistributing downward through wage increases is improving business by a long shot. And that growth is a very steady string of growth there. So whether or not restaurants are opening or closing, it's pretty clear that there's a lot more people working in restaurants, and that's not changing.
All right, so a couple of points here. Todd says on Twitter, statewide stats are always greatly skewed by Manhattan. That may be fair. And Mike says, isn't the real issue that restaurant owners don't want to increase prices to pay a fair wage and customers are too sensitive to price and in this way contributing to other unfair wages? That's from Mike. And the answer that we heard from a number of people on this the last time we had this program is that yes, that the owners of restaurants don't want to increase prices, that they could do that, but they're The estimation of many people in the restaurant world is that they're sort of at a really kind of marginal point there, that increasing prices on menus is going to chase out a number of customers and that will offset any gains. But I think what we're hearing from people like Mike on Twitter is, do you really know that? And why can't customers understand the relationship between what we're paying and what we choose to pay for food and what economic systems do with workers? So, Mohini, how do you feel about that?
How I feel about that is that, like, when it comes to prices, I think what a lot of people leave out is that, like, prices increase through a lot of forces, like one of those being inflation anyway. And actually, Rock, the Restaurant Opportunity Center, has a report called A Dime a Day that shows that, like, the impact of raising wages for restaurant workers by just a matter of a couple dollars would really only affect prices in a matter of dimes.
Okay. Two other issues to hit here, and then what I want to do is open up to more of our listener feedback here. Listeners, if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We talked a little bit about automation on the last program, and two different points came up, and I think that they are important to discuss. Number one, there was a pushback to whether automation is happening, and we do see in a number of places that there is more of the, you know, order with a smart pad as opposed to talking to humans. And everything from the Lentos of the world down to the Paneras and the Wendy's say we're going to automate more if prices have to go up. One of the pushbacks I also got, though, was from, I believe, one of your colleagues at Metro Justice. I don't want to quote unfairly. I'm trying to remember a lot of the Twitter interaction, was that it sort of doesn't matter prices, that if restaurants can figure out how to eliminate human workforce, they will anyway. That this is what corporations generally do. If they can cut out the human labor cost, they will do that. And we're going to see automation in one form or another because we're not valuing human work anyway. And I thought that was an interesting point. And in our next hour, we're talking about sort of socially conscious investing. I think that's something to explore there as well. Colin, automation. Are we moving more towards automation when we move wages in this direction, or do you think it's inevitable anyway?
I don't think wages have to do with whether or not we're moving towards automation. I think we're moving towards automation one way or another. I think that that's been a national trend that's been moving for a long time. And in fact, I think it's one that really, for me, means we need to interrogate the way economics work in this country, right? So if the primary way that the vast majority of us make our survival, our living happen, is through labor to help for the profit of companies, if that's the methodology that we use to make our living, then automation means that we're going to have a lot of unemployed, destitute people and some very profitable companies. That's going to lead to an incredibly skewed wealth distribution in the country. If we can figure out some other ways to really share wealth in really genuine ways, then automation can actually just mean less work for an already largely overworked population. So I think that could be really interesting. I think in the restaurant industry, though, I think maybe Zach or Nadine could speak more to like what that would mean in a restaurant industry, because service is very different than automating the like auto factories, for instance, right? You feel the personal impact of that in service in a way that you don't necessarily when you buy a car.
Zach, are you concerned that your job's going away, whether it's at Lento or other restaurants, as a server, if we continue in this direction? And does automation, does that conversation come up at work?
Automation doesn't, I wouldn't say it's come up often, particularly in the service industry. I think we have a sense that part of what makes restaurants is the service staff. I think that goes back to the history of where restaurants come from. You know, it comes as a place to invite others into your space and to provide them with an experience. And I don't think that we could look at, quote unquote restaurants that have like pads and you go up to like counters. I don't think that they're the same kind of restaurants. And I think that, you know, like Nadine and I both work in small local businesses, and we know that part of what makes our business appealing, part of why we enjoy our jobs, part of why we got into it is for that community connection, for the service connection. And so I think it's just kind of an odd, I find it disrespectful to even entertain the notion of restaurants without serving staff, because it kind of shows me that servers aren't viewed at as like professionals and as people that are vital to that environment. I think that we are.
I think you're right. And I think the owner of your restaurant's right. And he said on this program that we are moving toward chain ownership of just about all restaurants, and you will cease to see local small restaurants that put an emphasis on service.
I think that's a that's an understandable claim when you're looking at like the kind of the extremes where we could go. But I think that we can have different systems. You know, I think that A is that we need servers and we need workers that have basic rights and basic access to like wages and stuff. And like Nadine was saying, you know, if we're not upping everybody, if we're not bringing all workers up together, then like I'm not going to be able to go out and spend money at restaurants. I'm not going to be able to engage with that part of the community. And so. It's all like circular, you know. It all like invests in itself, and so I think that you can't like ignore the very real struggles that workers are going through. That's gonna determine whether or not they're gonna be able to engage with their communities at the same level that we want to. You know?
Nadine, thoughts on automation?
Well, I work at a family-owned and operated business in a historic building that's been standing for 90 years. So when it comes down to it, I think that the experience that people are looking for when they go into a restaurant, if it's the automated service that they're looking for, then we already have Wendy's and Panera and other types of businesses like that. And they do well, and that's its own sort of thing. But table service and that individualized attention and going into a business and feeling like you're part of the family and that you're welcome there and that you're part of this wider community that's in your neighborhood. Businesses like that, I really want to see businesses like that thrive in our community. And they can't thrive in our communities if people can't afford to go to them.
So the broader question for, and I'm going to direct this to Colin, who is the organizing director of Metro Justice, is whether we can have a society that now makes sort of a values choice, that businesses aren't going to be open if they can't pay workers X, if they can't pay workers a living wage, whatever, however so determined. If, number one, we should make that destination economically a goal, and if on the way there, if there's going to be some collateral damage. And the New Yorker directs us to a Harvard Business School professor named Michael Jensen, who created the agency theory developed in the 1980s that sought to align the interests of managers with those of the company's investors first. And that alignment, according to the New Yorker, led to huge stock option pay packages for top corporate managers and an intellectual framework that justifies doing anything within the law to increase a company's stock price, whether that be polluting the environment or firing workers. So you go, and we're going to talk again more about this next hour, but that model really developed in the 1980s is still with us and still dominant. We can talk about socially conscious investing. It hasn't really dented that kind of a model. So what is your view of the larger economic model, the goal of it, and what it would mean to get there? Mm-hmm.
That's a huge question.
Yeah, do we have a week? I know.
Yeah, but I'll start off by saying that I think you're absolutely right that business, particularly in the last 40, 50 years, but throughout its history, has been focused on profit and profit for a handful of people involved. And that's why there's a labor movement. That's why there's been worker movements to come together to like actually negotiate collectively over wages and standards and benefits. And I think it's particularly interesting right now when we're living in some of the wealthiest times this country's ever seen, and people on the bottom just aren't seeing it, right? Business is doing great in this country right now, and every time we talk about marginal increases for working people, it's attacked back and attacked back and attacked back. And at the same time, we're watching through really aggressive union-busting tactics and intimidation tactics, the private unionization rate in this country slip over and over and over and over again. The negotiating power of your average worker at this point in this economy is nil. And so it's the rebirth of movements like the Fight for 15, like what the Restaurant Opportunity Center is doing in organizing restaurant workers. It's these sort of moments and movements that I think are getting our country back on track. I think these are about really redistributing wealth and wages in a way that starts to even us out and starts to pull people away from poverty and starts to and frankly, I think there is a way that it can be done that salvages some of these companies that salvage like a bunch of these companies. If a bunch of companies tomorrow move to tablets, a bunch of other companies tomorrow are not going to have customers. Right. That sort of crisis in decision making, that short term profit thinking leads us to is exactly what I think has really destroyed the economy of the country in a lot of ways and what's really sent a lot of people into poverty. So, you know, my first prescription, I would say, for the economy is mass organization of working people into union movements that can really genuinely have an industrial renegotiation of how industries work. And I think that things like the Fight for 50 and the Restaurant Opportunity Center are steps in that direction.
I want to read more, a little bit more from the New Yorker piece that I was talking about there. Quote, when American Airlines agreed to raise prices for its pilots and flight attendants last April, analysts at a handful of investment banks reacted bitterly. This is frustrating, a Citigroup analyst named Kevin Crissy wrote in a note that was sent to the bank's clients. Labor is being paid first again. Shareholders get the leftovers. Jamie Baker of J.P. Morgan also chimed in. Quote, we are troubled by AAL's wealth transfer of nearly $1 billion to its labor groups, end quote. Those comments were mocked online, but similar sentiments are everywhere in the financial establishment. Both Costco and Whole Foods, whose CEO John Mackey wrote a book called Conscious Capitalism, have been criticized by Wall Street investors and analysts for years for being, among other things, having a habit of paying workers above the bare minimum. So, you know, with the current system, Colin, there's a risk to, quote, paying workers first above shareholders. And what we saw that with in the airline industry, we saw it in different industries in just the last year. Investors don't like it. Analysts don't like it. Wall Street doesn't like it. What is the way to create a system, in your view, in which we wouldn't have any businesses open that can't pay workers a living wage? And are you willing to accept that if we choose that as a value, that could mean a restaurant, small local restaurants here and there? Not all. I know you think they claim the sky is falling when the sky is not is falling as much. But if there's collateral damage, is it worth it to get there to create that kind of a structure?
Look, there's collateral damage right now. spend some time in the north side of the city, right? Like go meet the fast food workers who are propping up the profits of Wendy's and Burger King, right? Hang out with the workers that keep Denny's open. There's collateral damage right now. And that collateral damage is to hear that, you know, hedge fund managers and stockbrokers think that they're having a hard time. Just to me, frankly, shows that the people running our economy are totally out of touch with reality. And they're out of touch with the reality of how everyday people are living and the sort of struggles that people are making. This isn't about deciding, you know, maybe I can't take three grand vacation to the Bahamas this year. Maybe I can only take one. This is about people choosing between rent or not rent. This is people choosing between, you know, food or electricity. And that's been increasingly the standard that working people are left with all the time. So when we talk about whether or not there's collateral damage, there is already and has been very substantial collateral damage for decades and growing, right? So we're at a crisis moment whether or not the business community sees it.
All right. And so before I go to the phones, and we're about to open it up to some feedback from the audience, the last follow-up to that would be, do you dispute the claims of whether it's the owner of a higher-end restaurant or what you would call sort of a middle price restaurant, that if it's the tip wage credit going away, if it's a $2.90 increase for server minimum wage, or if we went to $13, if we went to $15, do you dispute that there would be closures at the level that those owners say there would be?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they've said the sky was falling for decades and it hasn't fallen, right? What I would challenge, and this is why I really speak to the need for genuine unionization of workers all over the place, right? If a crew of restaurant workers had a union and went and said to their boss, we're going to have real negotiation, we're going to get a contract together and negotiate over wages and benefits, one of the first things that they would do is ask for an opening of the books, right? How many people right now are asking any of these restaurant owners, you know, hey, you're saying the sky's going to fall. Okay, can we see your books? Can we see what your margins are really like? How are you paying yourself and how well are you doing as an owner? You know, the owner of Sticky Lips was at all of the wage theft hearings across the country, across the state. Or I'm sorry, the wage board hearings of the fast food wage. And he was at all of them saying how hard it was going to be. He was never going to be able to take up this kind of wage. First of all, the wage didn't apply to him. But I asked him there, how many boats do you have? And it was pretty clear to me from the look on his face that it was more than one. Right. He's not hurting. He's not hurting nearly to the degree.
But some restaurant owners are not living high on the hog.
Sure. But I think we should have that open conversation. And like there was no open, transparent. Here are my books. Take a look at them for yourself. Tell me how I can handle my business in a different way. And there's a reason that transparency never happens. And that transparency never happens because it's really helpful to hide profit, frankly.
And Nadine, if you were to talk to the owners of the Dutch Mill where you work, do you have conversations like that? Do you say, look, I mean, I appreciate having a chance to work here, but I mean, I think I should be at $15 an hour, and I think you can afford it. Have you had that conversation?
The conversation that I've had with the owners at my work has been about the increase or the elimination of the tip minimum in particular, getting minimum wage. And I've gotten pushback on that. And, you know, I've found nice ways of saying it. But when it comes down to it, my question is not just me, all the bartenders and the cooks and everybody that works at that restaurant and every other restaurant, we made that money with our hands, with our time, with our sweat, with our loyalty. And what we are asking is to be able to support ourselves for having done all that. And quite frankly, my situation at the Dutch Mill is a lot better than situations that other people are in at other restaurants.
But do you agree with Colin? I mean, he asked the owner of Sticky Lips, how many boats do you have? I don't know the answer, but I think a lot of owners of smaller, single restaurants, non-chains, don't have the money for boats.
It depends how long the place has been open. The owners of the Dutch Mill have had that business open now for 1 year and 3 months. And that is not enough time to have accrued 3 or 4 or 7 boats. But as far as other small business owners, not just in the Rochester area, but in general, and then that's not even talking about corporate chains. That's not even talking about your Friendly's or your Wendy's or your Perkins or your Longhorn Steakhouse and the profits, the profit margins that those people have. And the audacity to say that we don't deserve to be able to meet our basic bills. We don't deserve the standard minimum wage that everybody else gets for their work. When your business is profitable and successful because of our devotion and because of the attention and time we spend on your customers.
All right, so let's bring in someone who has been listening and was here last time. It's Art Rogers, who owns Lento. Art, welcome back to the program. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Thanks. I feel this is so unfair. I am a hardworking person that comes into work every day, works alongside my crew. I live in an $80,000 house in the city of Rochester. My kids go to city schools. You know, we have one car. I have had maybe 2 profitable years in 10 and a half years. I've had to borrow, scrimp, save, work my butt off. I agree with what Zachary said before. It does go in peaks and valleys. That's the fault of Lento. I would love to be doing 250 covers the 5 nights that we're open. But the reality is, because of seasons or because of weather, I mean, there was a time last week when we did like 12 people on a Saturday because of the blizzard. I can't control that. I think this panel assumes that I'm some kind of millionaire, and many of us restaurant owners are millionaires on our yachts and we're just hoarding our profits. I would be embarrassed, but I would open my books to Zachary and the staff and show them that I barely get by month to month, and it's so stressful to own a restaurant, and I feel like they're just making assumptions or lumping us all into one group.
Okay, so hang there for a second, Art. Some response, and Zach, I'll let you respond too, then, because I appreciate the fact that you're here, that Art was here, that we're having this dialogue. It's important. Does that move you, what you just heard?
I mean, most definitely. You know, I like, for me, once again, it's not about like personal disagreements that have like come about in my workplace or like specific experience that I've had, because it's something that I've identified with amongst the whole industry, you know, and like working in low wage jobs. And like, I do appreciate that, like, you know, the idea of you opening our books. That's something that I think that like we need to explore more in terms of how can restaurants all work together, you know, owners and serving staff. And I think that the Restaurant Opportunity Center has also talked about that they actively find ways to work with restaurant owners to make more equitable business models that you know, treat all of their workers fairly. So yeah, I think that's like definitely a process to explore. But I think that it's something that the only way that I've seen that is through workers organizing and through like, you know, having these kind of conversations that we're having now. So I think that like, I think it's still a standard that we need to figure out how to fix. It's not something that's okay. Workers going under the experience of the kind of like conditions that that service workers do and the kind of incivility that we do can't be the standard that we have as a society. And so I don't know what that looks like. But all I know is that, like, you know, I can't afford to eat at my at the restaurant that I work at. I can't afford to bring my family to the restaurant that I work at. And to me, that says that that shows that there's a difference, you know, and I think that's something that needs to be explored.
All right, so let me ask Art if that moves him. Go ahead, Art.
Yeah, it does, but I feel like that's – well, let me ask you this. If you, Zachary, were getting 40 hours a week with the average tips that you're getting because we were always busy – would you be able to go out to Lento and take your family out to Lento if that was the case?
Yes, but that assumes something that we're not working with right now.
Right, but that's my reality. I mean, I am not busy enough. A lot of my costs don't change. I still have the same rent, the same insurance, the same RG&E. I mean, there's a million things that you have to pay for when you own a restaurant. And I would love to offer health benefits and pay everybody, you know, a great wage, but that just, it doesn't, it's not, I mean, it's not reality for Lento. Maybe it is for some other restaurants, but I feel like this panel is just lumping all restaurants and restaurant owners into one pot.
Okay, can I ask a couple of questions?
Same.
Yes, Colin wants to follow up. This is Colin O'Malley, Organizing Director of Metro Justice. Go ahead, Colin.
I'm interested in a given night, in a given shift, how many servers do you have on?
I'd say on average we have 4 servers, 2 bussers, and 3 bar staff. So
and are those
like
are all earning? Those are all earning the tipped minimum?
Yes.
Okay, so 9 folks earning the tipped minimum for how many hours?
Maybe Zach could answer that better, but I would say
an average of five
hours.
Okay, so you've got 45 shift hours there, and we're talking about right now a shift of about $290 an hour, so I'll say 3. So we're talking about $150 a night on an average night. That's enough that you think puts the restaurant under?
Well, I don't understand your question.
So the wage increase we're talking about is a $3 an hour raise. The hours that you just said, there were about 45 hours a night worth of workers that would earn that wage. So we're talking about $150 a night in increase in wages. That's sufficient. That's enough that you think it puts Lento under?
Probably. I mean, if we are averaged before this, I knew this conversation was coming out, we're open about 247 days a year. So multiply 150 times 5. And then multiply that by 247.
247 weeks a year? I'm sorry.
247 days a year. 247 days a year.
Sorry, I don't have a calculator.
And he's saying $150, but times 247, Colin. And he's saying,
well, we're open 5 days a week, though.
Yeah.
So that's $37,000 a year. That's roughly the cost of like one full time staff person at a good wage, right? Frankly, to me, if a business is going to go under for a $37,000 a year increase, and that business employs the number of people it does, and frankly, I've been to Lento. I like Lento. I enjoy the restaurant, but like that to me as a number, if that's the number that puts a restaurant under, I think there's a lot of deeper problems with the business model than wages.
Okay, go ahead, Art.
I came with a completely different number. We did it last time when the state mandated the tipped wage. I think that was a $2 increase.
$2.50,
yeah. Accountant, that had cost us over the year, it was over $100,000. And that was the last time. So they're asking me to do that again.
Okay. We're trying our okay. Well, I guess what I want to get to here is the question, though, Colin, of if this is enough to put Art under. I mean, like, I don't have any reason to dispute the numbers that Art is bringing as a business owner. Is this part of that collateral damage that could happen? And are you saying, because what you're also calling for is not just the $3 increase and the removal of the tip worker credit, but a higher wage to begin with, 15. And if that happens, if we see a closure, is that part of a society restructuring itself to make values choices on what businesses can and can't pay workers?
Yeah, I think it is. I think if at the end of the day there are a handful, like, and you know, to be clear again, industrial standards are that as wages have risen, we have seen massive increase in the restaurant industry, right? So, like, again, I don't think that's going to happen. I think there might be some businesses that close, but I think restaurant employment overall will increase, right? That said, if what we end up with is a drastic reduction in a city like Rochester's poverty rate, I think it's okay to have a few fewer restaurants and a drastic reduction in poverty in a city like Rochester. The sort of problems that poverty, concentrated poverty, racialized poverty have in Rochester, I think have such damaging impacts that, yeah, I think at the end of the day, we need to figure out an economy that gets away from that. And if you know, if answers like this aren't the one, then I look forward to hearing business leaders' answers. But frankly, up to this point, what business leaders have said is everything's fine.
Art, some final thoughts from you, and then I'll let the panel go, because I got a lot of other people want to jump in. Go ahead, Art.
I mean, I agree with 95% of what this panel, just like last week, the woman that was on, I agreed with a lot that they have to say, and I've been making moves in the back of the house to make sure everybody is well above the minimum wage for when that goes through, because I agree with that. Like, the minimum wage is too low, and it should be higher, but for... And it's no control of mine that my business isn't more regular with the amount of people that are coming in week to week.
Can I speak to that?
Sure.
But Art, I'm one of the restaurant workers in Rochester, and I've never been able to afford to eat at Lento, and I would love to be able to. And getting the same minimum wage as everybody else on top of my tips would allow me to do that. $150 a night is like, what, three tables, basically. If you had three tables that were all restaurant workers who were excited about enjoying your service because we really appreciate a high standard of service because that's what we deliver in our work, I mean, I understand that you're afraid, and I understand that the restaurant business is very stressful. Everybody who works in a restaurant feels that, from the management all the way down to the dishwasher. But we could all benefit from the growth in this industry. And we could use it to prop each other up.
Like I said, I mean, I could take you aside. I'd be happy. You could, I'd open my books to you, and then you can see what some real stay awake all night, sweating in your bed stress looks like, having to run a business and being responsible for so many things. There's no one on there that has, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but is there anybody on that panel that has owned a restaurant or owned a business?
No, but I manage a nonprofit, and so I manage the incoming money for a nonprofit and therefore the wages of the number of people that we hire.
And if they said that we're going to cut that in half, you would just be like, all right, well, we'll just make do.
No, but nobody's saying that.
Right, nobody's saying that, but what if?
No, I mean, nobody's saying that to you either, if we just cut your income in half. In fact, what we're saying is if you increase wages across the board, you will see increased sales. And in fact, and that's been shown, I think, over and over again.
So I
appreciate
statistics.
I'm sorry. It's not just made up statistics that the restaurant industry in New York State has grown by 100,000 jobs. I mean, it's like 40% growth in 10 years, and those have been 10 years of wage increases. So I think I appreciate that, like, and I totally get this. I look year to year at a budget, and year to year I look at a budget and say, wow, if I had to increase costs a bunch tomorrow, it would be a real problem. The problem, of course, though, is that everything else changes around it. So if tomorrow you have to increase wages and that's the only thing that changes, yes, I could see how that's a problem. But I think what we find over and over again is when wages are increased, so are sales.
You guys have your statistics to look at. I'm sure I could find statistics that prove that otherwise. I'm just giving you my comments based on my real-life experience of owning a small independent restaurant that spends a lot of money as well on local food that costs a lot more than most restaurants as well, which I could definitely sacrifice that, but then would Lento be Lento after I had to do that?
Yeah, I take the point of that. First of all, just because we're working some other voices, Art Rogers, the owner of Lento, thank you for calling. I appreciate that perspective. I want to bring in John Albert, who's on the phone. John's the president of the New York State Restaurant Association, who's been listening, who wanted to jump in. The Rochester chapter, I should say. And John, I'm sure you've got some things to share as well with this panel. Go ahead, sir. Thanks for calling. Are you there, John? Hold on one second. Hi, John, you there? How about we come back to John in just one second, because I also have a different John, John from Rochester, on the line with us. Go ahead, John. Are you there, John?
Hello.
Which John is this? Go ahead, sir.
John from Rohrbach.
Go ahead. Go ahead, John from Rohrbach. Go ahead.
I just wanted to comment, as we look at this and we look at minimum wage, and minimum wage is it's an issue that's been argued for a long time. You could argue, well, prices are going to go up, and therefore, in the one example where we would hope that our restaurant employees could come into establishments and enjoy it, you know, in theory that all works, but if prices are higher, even though you're making more, it may not translate into that. But the important point I wanted to make, everybody says there's a par minimum wage. The way that the tip tax credit goes is that it actually, if you are not making, or let's say you make enough tips, we can take that off and bring the wage down. But everybody makes minimum wage. So you really should, what this argument is, or what we're talking about today, is should servers actually make a little bit more? Because if they come in on a slow day, I mentioned that one day that was Saturday that hardly anyone came in, it's the owner's obligation to pay minimum wage. So if it's $10.75, that's what the server's going to make. They already make minimum wage. No one makes less than a minimum wage unless there's an operator that doesn't follow the rules. But changing the rules aren't going to make those operators play by the rules. So the fear is that if we start paying a minimum wage across the board, the tips will go down because patrons will feel, well, this server or this bartender is really making, you know, a fair wage anyway. So I think the system works. You know, my biggest fear is if this happens that our prices will have to go so high that it just has an overall impact on the industry, including not only the operators but the servers, and they won't be making the tips or the income that they used to make if patrons can't afford to go out.
But, John, just a couple of years ago, you had to raise wages $2.50 an hour because of sort of a step-by-step increase that we've been seeing for tip workers, and I don't think that eliminated tipping in New York State, did it?
I agree with that statement. I don't think it did. I think there are some people that might have, and this is just a feeling on my part, that I don't think there was that much of an impact, but maybe people used to tip 20%, they tip 15%. I mean, they know that increase was a 50% raise. I think in my working career, I never got a 50% raise.
But John, I'm with you that if every one of your diners was aware of that and staring at every bill, they're going, let me do the math in my head. But I just don't know people who have done that, and I'm not trying to be flip here. I'm just trying to say I think it's an idea that you have in your mind. Does it bear out that people are tipping less because it went up $2.50 an hour a couple of years ago?
Yeah, but the argument, and I Evan, I see where you're coming from, and I don't disagree with that.
Okay.
And it did work, and this just happened too. I guess the other argument would be, this just was in, it's been in less than a year. Why don't we look at it a little bit later? Or look at the overall minimum wage? Because, again, my point is we're kind of targeting our industry, but our industry does pay minimum wage. We just happen to have the ability, if you have a really good shift, and I think most of our servers, I hope, and most of our bartenders, based on the tips that they actually claim, they make significantly more than minimum wage. So that we can pay a little less to keep our menu pricing reasonable. And what it also does, too, as a diner, I think it gives the diner the ability to make that choice. This person did a fantastic job. I'm going to tip them a little bit more. Or this person didn't. Maybe I'll hold back. If it's already built into the price of the food, you're taking that choice away from the diner.
John, I appreciate it. It's always good to hear from you. Thanks for taking the time to call. He's calling from Rohrbach Brewing Company, so let's get some response there from the panel. I mean, the arguments that John is making there are very common and very sort of vociferous arguments across the state that we're hearing, trying to convince Albany not to go ahead with this. Mahini?
First of all, I think it's a very, very prevalent misconception right now that raising the sub-minimum wage, the regular minimum wage, is going to eliminate tipping, and that's just not true. Like you've already said, when the tipped minimum went from $5 an hour to $7.50 an hour, people are still tipping. Same thing in seven other states with one fair wage. People still make just as much money from tips, if not more money in tips. Partly because, like we've said multiple times now, if restaurant workers are making more money, they go out to eat more. And we, all of us in the industry, know that when restaurant workers go out, we eat more, we drink more, and we tip better. So So that's one point. As far as prices go, like I've said, like there's a very detailed report by the Restaurant Opportunity Center called A Dime a Day that analyzes prices, and it shows that the increase in prices will be pretty much negligible. And even with that negligible price increase, like all of us in the service industry also know that like a slightly bigger bill also means slightly larger tips. 20% of a slightly larger bill is more tips, so it's actually really good for servers and bartenders.
All right, so last comment from the audience, and we could have done both hours on this. I know there's a lot of strong feedback on this. What I want to do is mention that we wanted to talk to John Albert, who's president of the New York State Restaurant Association. Rochester chapter had called in, snafu with the phone system, and I'm down to our last minute. So I'm just going to tell John, let's talk again on a different day, because apparently we've got a lot more to discuss with this situation. David on Twitter says, it's so easy to think the money just grows on trees when you've never had to make payroll. That's one of his pushbacks, saying everyone wants more, but it's harder for the owners. So, Colin, some final thoughts from you here. You heard from John at Rohrbach. David is saying this is easy to be theoretical. It's harder in practice.
And the statements from business owners up until this point have been theoretical and anecdotal. The industry is growing by like very clear measures, and the industry is growing through wage increases. So, you know, I'm sorry, to hold ownership to the same standard we're held to, when workers make demands, we're held to a much higher standard of what to expect and how much our demands, because the power structure of society really says that ownership, they're the job creators, they know what's going on. At the end of the day, I think we've shown very demonstrably that wage increases are better for workers, better for business, and better for the economy at large. And I think that's been demonstrably true for the last decade.
Totally unfair 10-second follow-up, Colin. Can capitalism itself survive?
I think the only hope it has of surviving is finding a way to redistribute wages downward.
All right, so we're going to talk next hour about what conscious capitalism is or meant to be or truly is, and does it work in practice? Is there socially conscious investing? If you want companies to support better worker wages and conditions and environmental conditions, is there any way that you can do that in a way that puts pressure on them? In other words, is there a reverse Carl Icahn out there or a model for it? We're going to explore that next hour. And that's sort of an extension of the conversation you've been hearing here. Colin O'Malley, Organizing Director of Metro Justice, thank you for being here. Appreciate your time this hour. Mohini Sharma, who is with Metro Justice as restaurant worker organizer. Thank you for being here, Mohini.
Thank you.
Also, thanks to Zach Skinner and Nadine Morsch, also local servers working in the movement. Thank you so much for taking the time to come in.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks.
Short break. More connections next.